Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. I am joined this morning by John Newman, Senior Software Engineer and Java, Spring, and Oracle Technologist. John, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you on. I know we've been going back and forth. We finally got us both in the studio.
Been pretty busy, so it's about time I got in here.
Good problem.
Yeah.
So tell us if you could, kind of what made you initially excited about technology way back when?
One of the first things I did, when I was in my youth, I had a Commodore 64. It was my first computer. Father kind of brought it into the house and started playing around with that. A lot of online stuff was really the first kind of foray into the online world. 300 baud modem, graduated to 2400 baud. Did a lot of online stuff with my friends. Got into a little basic, programming back then. And then graduated to the PC. So kind of same thing. The internet was still growing. So at that point, got into, designing websites and kind of playing around a little bit. I was fortunate enough to be born at the right time, I think is really what it came into, because computers had just started to get popular around the time I got to high school, and it was what all my friends were doing. So it was kind of had a mixed group of friends. I played sports and everything, but I was also kind of that inner geek found its way out eventually.
Okay. What sports did you play?
I played football, basketball, and baseball.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Three seasons.
Yeah, pretty busy. Once I got to high school, it kind of died down a little bit just because of academics and went through a couple injuries and stuff like that. So unfortunately, it kind of died down, but I found out other things to take up my time and ended up having a good time in high school.
I think you're like the fifth or sixth person on Underserved to say that the Commodore was their gateway drug.
Yes, it definitely was. The old floppy drives, actually when I first started, it was tape, then kind of graduated to the floppy drives. And
Lodestar, *8,1.
Yep, exactly. So me and my buddies used to get together because pretty much we all had the same computers. And at that point, if we were playing online games or stuff, it was actually calling each other up. Used to wake my parents up at 2 or 3 in the morning with the phone ringing, couldn't connect for whatever reason.
Oh, the modem whistle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the phone would be ringing. So, we tried to do a bunch of stuff that way. And, a bunch of my friends were into coding. So that's kind of how I got my introduction through them, designed some, the graphics were very primitive back then. Didn't do a lot of sprite stuff, but a lot of common logic. Almost like choose your own path kind of games, stuff like that. So very, very basic stuff.
What's old is new again. Have you heard of Black Mirror Bandersnatch?
Yes, I saw it.
Yeah.
I followed the whole Black Mirror series.
It was really good.
Show. Yeah, it was. It was a really good show.
Are they making another season of that?
I don't know. I know they had season 5, which only had about 3 episodes, and I haven't heard otherwise. They're very close to the vest in terms of what they're going to do. So
I hope they make another one of those. And actually today, the last episode of The Mandalorian comes out.
Ah, yes. Disney. Haven't seen that yet. My wife and I were about to sit down and watch it last night.
I highly recommend binge watching it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So at 300 and 2400 baud modems, besides going point to point with your buddies, were you calling up like BBSs back in the day?
Or? Yeah. We all belonged to one BBS in particular that it was weird because you'd see everybody in school and then the first thing you'd do is go home at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and you'd all dial up and talk to each other online. Met quite a few people through there and that's actually how I met my wife.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. The best time we had was we actually found a phone number for a, it was a large university in the Cambridge area that we found an open line where we could go into the line. And then from in there, you could dial out to anywhere in the world. So we frequented quite a few German websites, German BBSs and Russian BBSs. So it was a lot of fun. Yeah. It was very popular at the time as well. So it was difficult to get on because, they were limited. To 64 lines or how much, they wanted to pay for their phone service. We just had some fun with that too, because we figured out the control sequences that if you filled up someone's buffer enough, it would bounce them off. So at that point, you could literally wait a half hour to an hour to try to get back on. You just keep hitting, the redial button, and eventually you'd get on. You'd have private chats, and as soon as you get into one of those private chats, if you saw the characters coming across your screen, you knew you were screwed.
Is this like IRC, or what was the chat technology?
It was just chat rooms built within the BBS software itself. So you'd have like a main room, or you could go off into a side room and invite different people that you wanted into it, or you could just have a private chat with, one other person. We used to go in, my buddies and I would all pretty much start our own channel and go in. The only time we'd really go to the main channel is if we wanted to mess with people.
So you managed to get out of high school without the FBI knocking, and then you go to college.
Yep. So I started at UMass Lowell. When I originally went to school, I wanted to be a physical therapist. The year I went into UMass Lowell, they had changed the program so that it used to be a 4-year bachelor program to get your PT degree. And the year I went in, they changed it to a 4-year program, and then you had to get a 2-year master.
Yeah.
So they let 120 people into the program, of which 30 from my particular program would get into the master's. So it was highly competitive. Mm. First semester, I got a D in psychology, and that pretty much ruined that. So I had a lot of people to catch up with. Kind of decided it wasn't my thing, kind of decided school wasn't my thing. I think coming out of high school, I'll definitely admit now that I was definitely not mature enough to go to school. I feel that my local high school didn't really prepare me enough. It's definitely changed now with, my kids coming out of the school. It's been a, much better experience for them. But I definitely feel, coming out, I wasn't ready. I made it about 2 years, kind of struggled through some classes, your human anatomies, your, chemistries and stuff like that. And then I decided I just wasn't going to go. So after that, I started working odds and ends jobs, I was working security in downtown Boston. Did that for a year or so, and then decided I got to get out of this. This is not the life that I wanted to spend. So at that point, I made my switch to, technology. So started with a night course, taking C at UMass Lowell Night School. Got my undergraduate degree in MIS. Took a lot of programming classes through that, some database classes, et cetera. It was more geared towards the business end of MIS, management, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't really my gig either. But at that point, I only needed a few more credits. So it made sense to just get that degree at that point. When I first started applying to schools out of high school, my dream school was to go to BU. So didn't get in there as an undergrad. I mean, I got in. I got into my major, which would have been PT as well, but just, financially, it was, much more expensive than a state school. Fortunately, by the time I actually got back to BU, I was actually working security, and I managed to get in to a company called MACOM. They were eventually bought by Tyco Industries. So when I was there, I was still into computers at that point, so I got in as an operator. Third shift operator, watching backups, printing out reports, looking over source code. If there was some sort of an issue at night or whatever, I'd go in and try to figure out the issue myself before having to wake people up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did not like waking people up. Other people had no problem with that, but not me, especially when I had to call my own father. So I'd be like, sorry, Dad, it's 2 a.m, I know, but there's a problem with your program. But I did that for about a good 6 months. I showed, interest in doing more than that. So again, I happened to fall into a fortunate time where this company was going through the transition to SAP. So SAP was really in its infancy at that point. And I used to walk around the office and wonder why all these people had German to English dictionaries on their desk. If I asked somebody and they're like, we have to translate all the screens from German to English because that's how raw the product was in the U.S.
Oh, wow. Point.
So got into that.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Yeah. I fortunately, by the time I started working on it, I didn't have to know too much German, which was a good thing. So I got into the basis aspect of SAP, which it depended on the company that you went to. Some basis people just solely focused on the running of the application, whereas other people, basis was you were the sysadmin, you were the Unix admin, you were the database, and you were also, you know, managing the application. So that really helped me out. The manager of that particular project at the time took a liking to me, had me do some, you know, very rudimentary like corn shell and C shell scripts for him, kind of see what I could do. Then got in the door there. For the next 3 years, I was working with SAP at that particular company. Decided there really wasn't a future for me at that company. So I branched out. I ended up hooking up with Accenture, working in their BPO organization, which was business process outsourcing. Mm. So I ended up at Boston Scientific in Natick and did the basis thing for a few more years. Decided at that particular engagement, it was more the traditional basis where you were just really dealing with the application because they had a dedicated team of database, you know, and Unix admins. That kind of got me in some trouble sometimes because I knew I could do things and, you know, it had to go through their procedures and stuff. And I get very frustrated, you know, waiting for people when I'm like, I can do this. I already know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And that would ruffle some feathers. Mm-hmm. Kind of got sick of the customer service aspect of the basis because you're dealing with a lot of users and, you know, you get some beauties out there where, you know, they didn't have their keyboard plugged in, but SAP wasn't working.
Yeah, Mike Bro told us a story about people picking up the mouse and flipping it over and talking into it.
Yeah, I had a nurse call me. So I worked for a medical devices company. This was prior to Boston Scientific. And I spent a good hour with her on the phone, you know, trying to diagnose this problem. And finally, I said, could you open up Microsoft Word for me? She's like, yeah, okay. So can you try typing something in that window? She's like, it doesn't work. So can you follow the mouse to the CPU? She's like, what's a CPU? And I'm like, a little box that your mouse is plugged into. So she followed the cord back. She's like, yeah, it's not plugged in. I said, yeah, I'm going to attend you back to, you know, tier one support.
Your case has been demoted.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, there were the share of those kind of calls. And I kind of, yeah, definitely got sick of that. So fortunately, again, this particular company was moving on to an automated CAD system. So I happened to get into that. There was Java 1.5 at the time. So it was pretty early on in Java. So I started working with that. It was a product called Windchill by Parametric Technologies.
Oh, so, PTC?
Yep.
Yeah.
Started working with that. It was, their product was more geared towards CAD automation, but in this particular company, it turned into like a large document repository. Next thing you know, I was there working on that product for 17 years, or it was 15 years after I did my basis stint there.
Oh, wow.
Moved through a lot of upgrades and, you know, different technologies with that particular company. We were really one of their biggest customers in the New England area. When we kind of said there was an issue or we had a suggestion, a lot of times you'd see it in the next release.
So you guys were using it. You were big customers of PTC's Windchill. Yes. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, we had a lot of really bright people working on the project at that time. You know, if we made a suggestion for their software or, you know, found a particular problem with their software, we would go right to the developers. We wouldn't deal with, you know, your tier one or your tier two support. That's how much leeway we had with them at that point in time. So I went through a bunch of upgrades with them. It was quite an experience. It's where I, you know, sunk my teeth into Java from that point on. My philosophy in terms of programming and programming languages is if you know one language, it's usually pretty simple to pick something else up because methodologies and structures, I mean, the underlying back end is always going to be the same. Mm-hmm. You're just dealing with different syntax. Mm-hmm. So I've definitely found that a lot in what I've done.
Well, you've been doing an awful lot of Java development, working with us. What versions of frameworks and tools are you using now and what do you like?
So we've moved on. I've moved on to Spring. We're, you know, on to Spring 2.0. So I just like, I enjoy Spring Boot very much just because it's simplified everything that you had to do manually before. So it's made things a lot easier to ramp up and get some more complicated product out there. Started to work with a little bit of the new JavaScript frameworks. So, and once again, everything that's coming out these days, it just makes the developer's job that much easier. Because you're not particularly worried with the stuff in the background anymore, where you can just concentrate on getting a finished product out, and you can get it out pretty quickly.
Yeah, the languages seem to have gone from, I took night courses to learn C at Harvard Extension School.
Yep.
That was a great course. I think the guy's name was Bruce Mole. He was a great instructor.
Yeah.
Like, after working 8-9 hours and then like going in there, like sometimes I'd be kind of dragging, but he had such enthusiasm for the material.
Right.
And I really wanted to learn C and then later C++. Yeah. Yeah, I remember working with C and like dealing with pointers and everything. And yeah, it's bare metal and you can do things very quickly or make things that are very performant. But it was like building with atoms. And then now the languages are like Legos or
you
know, you're just snapping things together and you can concentrate a lot more on the what.
Woohoo! This is my 25th recruiter call for the same job today. New high score! The 3-week wait between my first interview and my second interview is my favorite time of year. My recruiter says he is my best friend, but I haven't heard from him since I started the job 2 years ago. Your background in real estate and multi-level marketing makes you the perfect person to advise me on tech careers.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserve, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
Yeah, I mean, I started out, one of the classes I had to take at BU was like Organization of Programming Languages, which was basically programming in 5 different languages in one semester. So we had like Ada, Pascal, Fortran, all kind of earlier languages, and I graduated all the way up to like C. The most frustrating one I ever had to take was assembly.
Mm.
With assembly, if you program the wrong register, your computer crashes.
Mm.
So there were many frustrating nights, sitting there for a couple hours trying to get an assembly program done. It's like, why does my computer keep crashing? It's definitely come a long way. And I think it makes it easier for developers now coming out of college. I think it's much easier for them. I think in some ways you don't develop, you know, you haven't gone through those hardships of having that issue or that hurdle that you just can't get over just by coming out of a school knowing a programming language or picking up a program language. I think methodologies and, you know, patterns and stuff that you can figure out through experience, I think definitely helps in the long run. You learn how to break down a problem into simpler steps and how to, you know, kind of work it so that you get to an end goal much, much faster. Kind of one thing I've noticed with some, you know, some junior developers is, hey, yeah, I'm a coding whiz, but when it comes to researching a problem or troubleshooting, that's kind of where that's lacking in some respects. And I think the development of the progression of programming languages has made that kind of a lost art.
Having to bang your head against the wall and like methodically research something and break it down and test case it to death until you figure out what's causing the problem.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I prided myself on starting out really early is, you know, my ability to problem solve. And I've had plenty of managers who have appreciated that or kind of respected what I could do. Whereas, you know, I'll go back to my MACOM days. There was one day we were having a particularly difficult database problem and must have had 5 or 6 people looking into the problem. No one could figure out what was going on. And my boss happened to be on vacation at that point, of course. Like, as soon as you would step out of the building, the system would go down. That's just the way it was for him. And he got on the phone and he's like, everybody else go home. Leave John in an office for 4 hours and see what happens. And, you know, within 90 minutes of everyone leaving, the issue was solved. So it's one thing that's complex problems have always been a way for me to put myself ahead of other people, being able to figure those out.
Definitely a valuable skill, and that's not going away anytime soon.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Are there any lessons you learned either developing or working with garbage collection or version control or performance or things you'd want to share, just little tidbits that folks can think about when they're stuck?
In my experience, most of the times there's an issue, it starts at the back end. And kind of my methodology is to start at the lowest point and work up through the software. So most of the problems I've encountered in my life have been like Java, like you said, garbage collection kind of issues or JVM tuning. Probably 75% of the time I've looked at a problem, it's been because of that. Even that's become graduated at this point where it's much, much simpler. But back with Java 1.5, 1.6, you were tuning parameters all the time just to eke out that little bit of performance. Databases, you know, same kind of thing. It's, you know, it can take something as simple as an index not being on a particular column or something very simple that someone might overlook. So it's not necessarily always like a really difficult thing that's happening. Sometimes it really comes down to something very minor that someone has overlooked. You know, you think to yourself, it's like, oh, well, somebody must have already looked at that. It's got to be done. It has to be done right.
Question the assumptions.
Exactly. But don't give up, I think is, you know, probably the best advice I can give you. If you don't understand something, dig into it, because it's at some point it's going to come back and you're going to be like, you know, the light bulb will go off in your head and be like, wait a second, I did something like this 2 years ago or, you know, a year ago. Definitely take those hard times and turn them into something that you can kind of have like a memory bank of, I can go back and say, all right, this is very similar, you know, to something that's happened, or if not, it's quite similar to something I've done, but it might be a little bit different. But I think those issues where you have a hard time figuring it out makes it easier when you have a more difficult issue to figure out.
Yeah.
Put all those little pieces together and kind of get to the solution. But never stop learning. You know, don't be afraid to dig in and be out of your comfort zone to figure something out.
I remember way back when I was at Monster, we had to render resumes very quickly as we pulled stuff out of the database. And we were basically building up these strings in order to do it. And it was slow. We started looking at the usual culprit, like, is the database missing an index or is there something? No, it's pretty quick. And we would do stuff like drop all the buffering and caching every time we ran a query just to make sure, like, it was a worst case scenario hitting the database, and it was still quick.
Yeah.
We're like, all right, well, where's all the time being spent? And we ended up using Numega's true time in order to instrument the code. And I became a big fan of profilers then, because that'll tell you where the bottleneck is.
Exactly.
You might think you know, but it starts telling you, here's where all the time is being spent.
Yep.
The short version of that one was, with the string concatenations, we were constantly reallocating buffers. And so whenever we would do a concatenation, we would reallocate a bigger buffer, copy everything from before into it, and then append to it, and then do it again, 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 you know, hundreds of times a second, and then simultaneously for several resumes getting torn out of there. And we figured out that if you pre-allocated a giant buffer that normally you'd never need to reallocate and then just kept the pointer to where you were writing within it, it ended up being orders of magnitude faster.
Right.
That
What language was that?
That was actually VB.
It was VB, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Way back when I first got the Monster, they were using ASP and VB. And
okay.
We helped them move to .NET. That one took a while to pin down, but it was very satisfying once we did it. You're like,
there
we go.
Exactly. Yeah. And everyone's happy when you finally get to the end of a problem. So it's, that is a very satisfying feeling.
You do some development for fun, like side projects as well?
Yeah. Every once in a while. Yeah. I would just develop in spring for fun, pop up websites every now and then, just doing different sorts of database connections, that sort of stuff. I made music catalogs myself, developed a very rudimentary blackjack game, which was probably had a lot of bugs in it, but I always won. So, so it was good.
It must not be right.
Exactly.
I've been toying with doing some stuff with Alexa, that thing I showed you in the office there where you have the four monitors.
Yeah.
So in the office here, I built this thing with four Raspberry Pis that basically play videos in random order. And then we shot these little tiny videos of like people walking left to right, right to left, popping up, et cetera.
Yeah.
It looks kind of neat. And I have it so it's automated, so it turns on and off every day. But I thought it'd be kind of cool if you could be like a maestro, like, all right, clear everyone out. And then like all the videos stop. And then like add Andrew, add Colin. And then just those people started showing up by like maybe SCP copying the videos into the directory where they play.
Yeah.
But looking into it, it still looks like the Alexa stuff. Like you got to get into doing the Lambda functions.
Right.
If you're doing it to control a Pi and the Pi is behind a firewall, then there's either got to have a paid solution in order to allow that to be reachable. So I backburnered that one for now.
Right. No, I hear you.
So when you are away from keyboard, I think you do some youth sports coaching.
I started when my son was 5, who's now 23. Started coaching them, started coaching some soccer and some baseball. Continued on. So I've been coaching for almost 17, 18 years now. Definitely soccer is my main focus. Moved up through the ranks, you know, started coaching 5-year-olds. Now I'm up to coaching like high school level students, you know, student athletes, you know, kids that come from the high school into our, you know, program. 3 of my kids are now into field hockey. So I'm actually a certified field hockey coach as well. Started coaching that on weekends and stuff. Eventually I'd, you know, like to get to high school level, possibly, you know, when things kind of quiet down, and also finding a job that will allow me to do that. You know, it's been an adventure. You kind of, you learn how to deal with different types of kids, different personalities. And I think that kind of transitions into work life as well. You know, learning how to manage different people and how to handle, you know, different personalities in the workplace is definitely a huge, huge skill to have, especially from a contractor or consulting sort of relationship. You need to finesse those relationships so that, you know, you're not pissing people off or doing the wrong thing and trying to make them happy without going crazy.
That sounds like youth sports.
Yeah,
all the parents and the kids.
Yeah, that's.
I want to talk to you about my playtime, coach.
I've found over the years that definitely comes down to setting expectations with the parents right up front. I've been very fortunate to not have a lot of issues with parents in particular. I used to be one of those psycho parents when my son was younger. He, you know, played hockey, and I'd be the same thing. I'd be up in the stands going, like, well, why is he not on the ice? Why is he not on the ice? And I learned very on, it doesn't help you to talk to coaches about your kids. It the only person that typically ends up hurting in the end is your kid. You know, being that parent, I definitely understand where other parents are coming from. The organization that, you know, I coach in is pretty good about, they have a 50% play rule. So it's, you know, I'm not coaching selects. I'm not coaching these higher level programs where, yeah, the better kids are going to play, you know, more than some of the lesser talented kids. Mm. From that aspect, it, you know, I've still had issues, but they're few and far between, and it's typically resolved pretty easily. The other thing I do is I do a pretty good job of, I keep track of how long kids have played and, you know, what their play time is and over the course of a season. So there's one particular, I was coaching baseball one summer, and I had, you know, a mother, same thing. She was upset about her son's playing time. And at that point, I was keeping a spreadsheet of how many innings they played, what positions they played at. And I was able to pull it out. And I said, your son's played the most innings of anyone on the team. And I'm like, you should be the last one complaining about playing time. That kind of diffused the situation. So as long as you're kind of able to prove what's going on, I found it helps those type of situations.
If there's something objective and data-driven where you can very calmly explain it, a lot of times it'll diffuse it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you still get the hothead parents.
Oh, of course.
Like, my kid should be out there.
Yeah.
They're not fit to carry his gym bag.
Right. And especially at the youth level, it's like, well, how do you expect someone to get better if they're not going to play? Coaching is not just about X's and O's or where you are on the field. It's, you know, I like to think of it as it's life lessons as well. I mean, you're going to deal with adversity. You're going to learn how to grow from different situations and how to handle things. You know, we look at things tactically or physically on a field, whereas, you know, tactically gets that person's mind thinking. Or, you know, from a skill perspective, all right, how do I get better at this? What are my what can I do to get better at things? So it teaches those different life skills that, you know, these kids can hopefully apply as they get older. I never won one to like just win, win, win. You know, is winning great? Sure. Does it make the kids excited? Yeah. My biggest thing coming out of coaching is, am I seeing progress? So I get your son or daughter in April. What are they doing in June? Have they gotten better? Have they progressed through different stages of being able to be a better person, a better player? And most of the time I've had success with that. And for me, the gratification is, so if I coach at U14 and then I see a kid go up to U16 or get to high school and he makes the high school team and he's having fun and he's continuing to play, that's where I get my gratification. You know, if we win, great. And if we don't, like I said, I just want to see progress and see these kids progress and teams progress.
With soccer in particular, what would you say it is that you're having to try and skill up? Is it foot skills? Is it tactics? Is it soccer IQ?
The biggest problem I'm definitely having right now is kids coming up who don't have the skills, like in terms of foot skills or, you know, being how to dribble through pressure or just like dribbling in general. I mean, it's just, or like a lot of these kids come up, they don't know how to head the ball. They don't body position. How do you move your body to make your advantage or, you know, take away the other team's advantage? There's a lot of that stuff that's coming up. So unfortunately, you know, we'll spend the first month and a half with these players that come up and we got to teach them rudimentary basic skills that they should have when they get up, like just passing. You know, being able to pass with each foot, being able to pass, you know, in a straight line. I mean, it's a lot of little things like that that prevent these kids from getting to the U14 level where it should be focused mostly on systems and tactics. Mm. But you're spending so much time with skills. And once again, it's a town program. So, I mean, it's going to happen. That's kind of the frustrating thing for me and myself and a couple of the coaches have tried to come up with some ways. Like, my feeling is you have to start it. And the big push with USA Soccer now is the grassroots program, where it starts at 4 and 5 years old and they're learning set skills at those ages and just progressing rapidly up through the system. And unfortunately, I think a lot of programs or a lot of coaches don't want to follow that and they don't understand the end game. I mean, with the exception of the women's national team, look at the men's national team. They're terrible. Mm. And I think a lot of that comes from the system. It's the system coming up. They don't know how to play at a fast level. They don't know. The U.S. system has always been, especially for the men, it's been kick the ball up and see who can run it and get it and put it in the net.
Boot and chase.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think that starts at that grassroots level. And you're only going to see better performance at the highest levels if you start teaching it at the lower levels.
I think other countries definitely have that memo. I watched a game. My daughter, Caroline, plays U16, and we were watching a game. It was some of the top U16 teams in the United States playing against some of the top ones from Spain.
Yeah.
And the team from Barcelona, watching them, like you try to pressure them, they just triangle pass their way out of it. They could build. Mm-hmm. They weren't the fastest, most physical, you know, specimens of athletes, but they played so well as a unit. It was scary.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, if you look at the MLS, it's kind of the same thing. It's a group of individuals. It's not a team. Yeah, a team's always going to be one individual. And to me, the biggest difference between even just levels of soccer and the difference between international versus U.S., the speed of the game. The U.S. can never keep up with the speed of the game. That's the biggest problem. And it's because, like I said, it all starts at the bottom. If you don't learn those skills at the bottom, you're not going to be able to compete at a major level.
All right. Well, we've covered a lot of topics here. We will have show notes available for you. And the URL for those show notes is underserved.libsyn.com. That's underserved.libsyn.com. We're also keen to get your feedback. If you want to let us know what you thought of an episode, had ideas for future episodes, or if you were interested in becoming a guest on a future episode, best way to get a hold of us there is our email, underserved@syrinx.com. That's underserved@syrinx.com. John, thank you very much for joining us today on Underserved. Any parting thoughts or lessons you want to leave people with?
Keep trying new things and learn every day. There's something to learn. You'll never stop learning.
All right, good advice. Well, I'm glad we finally got together. Thanks again for coming down and being on Underserved, and we'll talk to you all again soon.
Very good. Thank you.